Good morning. It's Saturday, April 11th, and this is your week in review. But before we look at the state of the economy, can we just reflect for a moment on some of the idiots that people planet Earth? Here we are in a world where one large-scale terror attack can reshape the world, let alone one's portfolio. And we have this situation in Britain where, well, I'll let Michael Evans of the London Times describe it. A huge MI5 and police counter-terrorist operation against Al-Qaeda suspects had to be brought forward at short notice last night. This was April 8th. After Scotland Yard's counter-terrorism chief accidentally revealed a briefing document. And many of you have probably seen the photo of Bob Quick, who, in arriving at 10 Downing Street, was seen holding a sheaf of papers with the front page clearly available to photographers. Marked top secret, it had the names of senior officers involved in the operation, as well as the number of suspects and in which cities the terrorists were to be arrested. It also revealed that police in Manchester would force their way into homes, and the secret code for the operation was splashed across the top. Quick was headed to meet with Prime Minister Gordon Brown under the guise of seeing him on simple police reform. As soon as the photo was circulated, MI5 and Scotland Yard took steps to stop its publication, but then authorities had to immediately expedite the mission and arrest the 12 targets in broad daylight. Thankfully, they were able to accomplish this before these suspects were tipped off. As a senior officer said, this was a massive compromise of the whole operation. What we've learned since is that the group was targeting the Trafford Centre in Manchester, where some 140,000 shoppers congregate each weekend, and evidently Easter Sunday was the appointed date. Mr. Quick was immediately dismissed. "I deeply regret the disruption caused to colleagues in undertaking the operation and remain grateful for the way in which they adapted quickly and professionally to a revised timescale," said Mr. Quick. You know, this stuff happens all the time. Think about all the American intelligence authorities or congressmen who have left sensitive material lying around, or the former CIA director John Deutsch, who kept classified material on his home computers. Talk about compromising operations. I just find all this incredible, though of course no one should be surprised. After all, we're only ordinary men. Sometimes we dodge a bullet, as appears to be the case in Britain. Recall the attempt where the bomb in a car in a London parking garage only failed to go off because a fuse burned out. And other times we don't. And the result is a 9/11 that changes the world. Moving on, last week I praised President Barack Obama because he didn't break anything at the G20 summit, but then he continued on his goodwill tour of Europe afterwards, and it's pretty easy to draw some other conclusions upon his return. What did the president achieve in the 8 days he was away? Some have poo-pooed the $1.1 trillion pledge for the IMF and developing nations, but I view this as significant, and Obama had no small part in getting the other leaders to come to the table at critical junctures. Obama brokered compromises on financial regulation and, as we learned later, the selection of a new Secretary General for NATO, as Turkey expressed severe misgivings. Obama won over the bulk of Europeans, at least for now, and this is another point that cannot be underestimated, though the president's critics do anyway. On this, I have to note that unless they've traveled overseas a fair amount, it's better for some of the pundits to keep their mouths shut. To digress a bit, as I remarked in these pages at the time, when the Abu Ghraib story hit the international papers, that day I was on a ferry from Singapore to Indonesia, the only white, as all the passengers were reading local papers with the now famous picture of the hooded prisoner splashed across the front page. As it turned out, no one bothered me, but I wasn't real proud to be an American that day. I've also noted that when I engaged anyone on the issue of our leadership while overseas, the disgust for President Bush was virtually universal. President Obama began to change that sentiment the past week, and that's a good thing. He proved to be a good listener, and while I wouldn't have listed all of our faults as he did, just understand that Europeans and Asians know more about our own history than we do. It's always the elephant in the room overseas, so might as well address it on your terms and not theirs, and generally, Obama handled this well. But it is also true, as the Washington Post Jim Hoagland put it, that listening is not a policy. And from that standpoint, Obama's great adventure fell short. such as in the case of Afghanistan, where Europe coughed up an additional 5,000 troops for peacekeeping leading up to the August election there, but it seems likely they'll all be withdrawn shortly thereafter. This is not President Obama's fault. George W. Bush did indeed leave Obama a big pile of merd. But Obama's powers of persuasion have gained him little of real value thus far. Just look at North Korea and Iran. I wrote ad nauseum during the final months of the Bush presidency that this is 43's legacy as much as Iraq and Afghanistan, and it was unreasonable to expect an Obama administration to make any immediate headway. But it is Obama's responsibility now to prevent the mess from getting totally out of control, and on both fronts he is failing thus far, with time running out, particularly in the case of Tehran's Mary Mullahs. It's up to Obama to get Russia and China to cooperate on nuclear proliferation, and to date nothing good has happened. And am I the only one who finds it a bit ironic that in the case of both North Korea and Iran, they have now formally charged an American journalist with spying and are holding three women against their will? Iran charged its captive, held since January just this week, while the other two have been in custody in the north for about a month. You would think the United States would be able to get Russia to help in the case of the Iranian situation and China with North Korea, but that's not the case. I understand much of what President Obama was trying to accomplish while in Europe. He sought to lay the groundwork for the heavy stuff to come. He wants the world to have a different view of the U.S., but this is not the time of the early 1800s when news traveled by horseback or steamer. We don't have months to weigh decisions as Thomas Jefferson and John Adams may have. In some cases, we have just weeks to make the right call. Or should our president receive information on a threat you and I have no clue about yet, perhaps days or hours? Listening is great. Now it's time to lead. Turning to the stock market, what a rally. The S&P 500 is up a stupendous 26.6% since hitting the closing low of 676 on March 9th. Is it just a bear market rally or the start of a new bull market? That's the question of the day. I've told you where I come down. We won't see 676 again, but I'm hardly going to say it's the start of a new bull market. For now, I'll just stick with my December 31st, 08 prediction that we finish up 2009 significantly higher, and with all the major indices still in the red year-to-date, except NASDAQ, which is up almost 5%, we have a long ways to go. Personally, I'd love for the market to meander around current levels for the next 2 to 3 months, consolidating the recent gains while receiving more good news on the economic front than bad, but that would be too perfect. The week actually got off to a poor start on news we already knew, that the banks have a lot of toxic debt on their books. I mean, we heard the same arguments from the bears we've been hearing since the market cracked. These guys have been right, don't get me wrong, especially the likes of Nouriel Roubini, Stephen Roach, and David Rosenberg. Roubini is still convinced, as is economist Paul Krugman, that mass bank nationalizations are in our future. Stephen Roach is still calling for an anemic and fragile recovery, and that we are deluding ourselves, in his words, if we think the crisis is winding down. And Rosenberg reiterates that investors seem to have confused an actual recovery with the fact that the economy isn't detonating anymore. Markets right now, Rosenberg says, are dangerously extrapolating an improvement in the rate of change to an improvement in the actual level of economic activity. These are two very different events. Again, points well taken, but at least the rate of decline for most measurements is leveling off, and there are some lights at the end of the tunnel, as in workers checking the tracks after a bad accident to make sure the repairs hold and that it's safe for the train sitting patiently outside the tunnel to continue through on its journey without incident. Just thought I'd try out a different tunnel analogy. One sector that has shown distinct signs of bottoming is housing. Yes, delinquencies and foreclosures are still at discomforting levels, but in some parts of the country, particularly those most beaten down, there has been a surge of activity. CNBC had a segment the other day from Stockton, California, where some new homes were priced at around $150,000 to $190,000. And heck, they looked real nice to me. Granted, I didn't see the surrounding neighborhood, but I couldn't have been the only one thinking I could take my still considerable profit on my existing abode and buy a nice place like that, all cash if need be. Not that I'm about to move there, but others might be thinking that. Or perhaps the preceding is just another way of saying, don't sell California short. If credit loosens up and mortgage rates stay low for a while, don't be surprised to see a magazine cover by year-end with the title, The Rush Back to the Golden State. Then again, it's Good Friday. I'm fasting. And maybe the blood isn't flowing properly to my brain. Economist Erwin Stelzer noted the following in his London Times op-ed. Quote, the troubled housing market flashed mixed signals, and mixed signals are a considerable improvement over uniformly gloomy ones. Sales of existing homes are showing signs of strength, and mortgage applications are up. The index of pending sales, deals for which contracts have been signed but not completed, rose by 2.1% in February, perhaps in response to falling home prices that, combined with low 4.6% rates on 30-year mortgages, have made homes more affordable to more people. Erwin continues, no, the recession is not over, even though the stock market seems to think it might be. The job market remains weak. Some 5 million jobs have been lost since the recession started, 663,000 jobs disappearing in March alone. The unemployment rate has risen to 8.5% and may be headed higher, but the gloom is no longer unremitting. I would say, or as President Obama put it Friday, the economy is showing glimmers of hope. Sunday is Easter, a time of renewal, might as well be a little optimistic. Assuming some MI5 type doesn't leave a top secret manual on his chaise lounge while on holiday in Dubai. So, wrapping up the major catalyst for Thursday's stock market advance, remember the markets were closed on Friday, that propelled all the major averages into positive territory for a fifth straight week was the word that Wells Fargo is pre-announcing that, thanks to surging mortgage banking activity, it would have record profits in the first quarter. This, coupled with a New York Times story by Eric Dash that all 19 banks would pass the stress test mandated by the Treasury Department, had investors thinking, hey, maybe the banking system isn't on the verge of total collapse, and maybe some of the bigger players won't require any further capital injections. Others vehemently disagreed. But stocks rallied strongly nonetheless, and for the week, the Dow Jones finished up 0.8% to 8083, while NASDAQ was up 1.9% to 1652. That's your week in review for today. Happy Easter. We'll be back with you next Saturday.